Last week we began to look at the problem that Cephas introduced into Antioch and Paul's response to it in relation to verse 12 and the motivations that were driving Cephas in his decision making. We looked at the fact that in verse 11 the phrase "because he stood condemned" actually means because he knew better. And in verse 12 at the end of the verse that his driving motivation was his fear of the party of the circumcision. This evening what we're going to do is move on into verse 13, and we're going to address the issue of the rest of the Jews joining him in hypocrisy, with the result that even Barnabas was carried away by their hypocrisy. The issue of hypocrisy in separating yourself and holding yourself aloof. That's what verse 12 says he did. When the people from James came to Antioch, he began to withdraw and hold himself aloof. And we saw that on the basis of what Paul called his motivations and the cause of his actions and the things that he chose to do, were laying a foundation for his confrontation of Peter, so that as he confronted him, he could write the words of his confrontation so that the Galatians would understand exactly why he felt compelled to confront Cephas at this point in the scenario. On the face of it, there were some what I'll just call moral police that arrived, claimed that James was the author of their attitudes and doctrine. And before these moral police arrived, Peter was treating his fellow believing Gentiles as if they were fellow believers. And then, after these guys showed up, he began to treat those fellow believers who were Gentiles as if they were not fellow believers any longer. That's actually what he was doing. He may have not even realized that he wasn't even treating them as second-class citizens in the kingdom. He was actually altering the message to the degree that he was in effect saying they weren't fellow heirs of the kingdom yet, because they hadn't conformed to the demands of the moral police. However, as I call them moral police, we have kind of a negative overtone for that, especially in our culture. But the fact is, we have a little bit of a issue that we need to be clear on as we look into this, because Paul took offense with Cephas in his behavior, but Paul himself teaches in his letters that sometimes believers have to be moral police on occasions, part of our job. And Paul actually commands on some occasions, and we'll look at a few of them, that believers withdraw and hold themselves aloof from other believers. At least, I mean, that's the assumption that you're taking when you hold yourself aloof from them and withdraw from them, is that they're believers. Paul said to the Corinthians that you can't treat unbelievers like that because they're unbelievers. They're not a part of the family, and you have no basis for expecting any kind of behavior from them that would be godly or Christian. So you don't withdraw and hold yourself aloof from those that are in the world. I mean, you don't make them your bosom buddies and all that, but you do have a responsibility to befriend them and be friendly to them and be loving toward them in a sense that they can understand, so that you can witness to them and they might have a willingness to listen to you because you've treated them decently. And of course, Jesus made a huge impact in his treatment of people who were way below the par of the moral police in Jesus' day, and sinners and publicans and Republicans and Democrats and everybody were willing to listen to Jesus because he had this demeanor of, I don't know that you'd call it acceptance, but it was a demeanor of kind tolerance. And therefore, when he preached to them and taught them, they felt this kind tolerance, if not acceptance, because Jesus never taught that you could just be accepted for who you were. I mean, just accept me like I am. No, he would never say that. He would never teach that we ought to do that. His father doesn't do that. He didn't do it. But there's a difference between what you expect of unbelievers and what you expect of believers. And so this evening what I'd like to do is look at some of the places where Paul actually counseled believers to withdraw from other believers. And then we'll work with why he was offended when Cephas did it in this setting. In 1 Corinthians chapter 5, Paul is dealing with a situation in Corinth, and he introduces it in the beginning of the chapter with a statement that there is a fellow in their group that is practicing a kind of immorality that even the Gentiles are offended by. It's a kind of incest that even the Corinthian Gentiles found offensive. And the church in Corinth had, according to verse 2, become arrogant. And they were patting themselves on the back for being so tolerant and so willing to accept people regardless. And he says that's not legitimate. So in verses 3 and following, he actually insists that they not accept this guy, not tolerate him. In fact, they're supposed to assemble and deliver the offender over to Satan for the destruction of his flesh, which is a far more serious issue than just holding yourself aloof and withdrawing. But in verse 11, he says, I actually wrote to you not to associate with any so-called brother. If he should be an immoral person, or covetous, or an idolater, or a reviler, or a drunkard, or a swindler, not even to eat with such a one. Now there he actually insists that the Corinthians not even go to the very minor level of eating with somebody who is a so-called brother, a brother by personal claim, but who is also at the same time living immorally or covetously or idolatrously or engages in reviling or drunkenness and swindling. And, of course, this is a sampling, not a total. I mean, these aren't the only kind of people that you ought to withdraw yourself from if they claim to be Christian while they're doing it. So here he actually commands the Corinthians to exercise the leverage that they have over so-called brothers. And one of the issues of leverage is the issue that Peter has a problem with in Galatians, because we saw in our study in Galatians last time that his fear of the circumcision was actually a fear of what they would think of him. And what he's actually doing in 1 Corinthians is telling the Corinthians to use that leverage, because everybody to some degree is concerned about what other people think of them. And so I said, if a person claims to be a Christian but he's immoral, covetous, reviler, whatever, don't have anything to do with them, because the point is that that will create some pressure on them to evaluate whether what they're doing and saying is acceptable, because you won't accept it. And if a person really doesn't care what other people think of him, withdrawing from him won't hurt him a bit. He won't care. But most people really do care about whether others accept them or not. And in the Corinthian setting, the church had gotten into this, you know, we just need to love everybody, accept everybody, and don't worry about the moral faults that we find, because everybody sins and it's no big deal. And we're all sinners and we're all guilty, and therefore we don't want to be judgmental. And so look at what a good job we're doing, because we'll even accept somebody who's living with his father's wife. Paul called that being arrogant. So here is a place where he actually commands believers to become moral police and have nothing to do with people who call themselves believers or brothers, but who behave in the ways that are listed in verse 11 and following. Of course, that's a difficult area, because there's a sliding scale on some of these things. I don't suppose there's a sliding scale on immorality, immoral people, but what about covetousness? There's got to be some kind of at what point do you become covetous in our pursuit of stuff. There's even a sliding scale on drunkenness, I suppose. What point are you drunk? If you have a wreck and they test your blood alcohol level, they've got a legal definition of what's acceptable. But do we use the legal definition in our relationships? You're drunk. I'm not going to have anything to do with you.
What do you mean I'm a drunk?
And so on. Nonetheless, however you define these terms and however you, wherever you place yourself in relation to understanding of them, there comes a time when, as a Christian, you have to become a moral policeman and say, that behavior is unacceptable for a believer, and as long as you engage in it, I'm not going to have anything to do with you. In 2 Thessalonians, Paul wrote to the Thessalonians about some of the issues that they were facing, and he said in chapter 3, close to the end of his letter, in verse 6, we command you, brethren, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you keep aloof from every brother who leads an unruly life and not according to the tradition which you received from us. Keep aloof from every brother who leads an unruly life. So he's actually insisting that you separate yourself and hold yourself aloof. And then if you go on down to verse 14 in the same chapter, he says, if anyone does not obey our instruction in this letter, take special note of that man and do not associate with him so that he may be put to shame. Don't regard him as an enemy, but admonish him as a brother. But nonetheless, you don't associate with him if he's going to be unruly and ignore what the Bible says about his behavior. So again, in 2 Thessalonians, in chapter 3, in two places, Paul actually insists that we have a moral responsibility to be moral policemen. And then, in Titus, the letter that he wrote to Titus in chapter 3, he also says, reject a factious man after a first and second warning, knowing that such a man is perverted and is sinning, being self-condemned. Now, there's a background to the first and second warning thing, and I believe that background is Matthew 18. Jesus taught that if your brother sins, you should rebuke him in private, or at least talk to him in private to see if you can't resolve the issue. And if he hears you, great, and if he doesn't, you're supposed to take some witnesses to make sure that every word is established. And you're supposed to go back and talk to him again. That's the first and second warning. So after the first and second admonition, if a man continues to be factious, boot him. Reject him. He's a perverted man who's sinning and being self-condemned. So here, three times in three different letters, Paul actually insists that we as believers have a moral responsibility to be moral policemen to some degree. So why was he so upset with Peter withdrawing and holding himself aloof? Well, the reason is because what Cephas was doing was an illegitimate description of moral police work. Cephas did not have a case against the Gentiles in Antioch. He did not have a legitimate case in being able to accuse them of failing, like Paul is saying that we have a responsibility to do when a believer is failing. So there's a distinction there, but I want us to understand Paul's case against Cephas in Galatians in light of the fact that using our leverage to refuse to have something or anything to do with somebody when they get into these areas that are in contradiction to legitimate behavior by believers, I want us to understand that in light of his confrontation with Cephas. So, let's look at his case against Cephas. The issue in Galatians is absolutely not an issue of moral failure on the part of the Gentile brethren. And the reason why I say it's absolutely not, I mean, the fellows that came up from Jerusalem that said they were from James and were, you know, insisting on circumcision and law keeping, they didn't think that they didn't have a case. They thought that if you would not submit to circumcision, you came under that demand in Genesis where God actually told Abraham in the establishment of the covenant of circumcision that if anybody refused to be circumcised, he was to be cast out of the community of the faith. So, when these guys came up from Jerusalem and began to insist that the Gentiles had to yield to circumcision as a requirement, they didn't think that there was absolutely not a moral failure here. They felt like there was absolutely one. It started with Paul and his refusal to preach and teach this, and then it continued with his audience who claimed that they were saved people, but they'd never been circumcised. They thought they had a case, but the fact is they did not. And I want to argue my case along these lines. In the first place, it's not a moral failure for a person to act within the boundaries of the laws that are set over them. Everybody would admit that. If you're keeping the laws that you're under, you can't be accused of moral failure. If the law says that you're not supposed to do something and you refrain from doing it, nobody can accuse you of breaking the law. If the law says to do something and you do it, nobody can accuse you of moral failure. It's an open shut thing. Nobody believes it's a moral failure to live within the boundaries of the laws that you're under. The Gentiles were in effect being accused of something else. And that is, they were being accused of being unwilling to accept the laws that they had now come under because they were believers in Jesus. We'll get to that in a minute. So, first point, it's not a moral failure to act within the boundaries of laws that you're under. Secondly, it's not a moral failure to act outside of the boundaries of laws which have never been set over you. If you live in Germany and you drive on Autobahn, the information I have is that there's no speed limit there. So you can drive however fast you want to. But you cannot come to the United States and drive like that because there are laws here that you are subject to while you're here. But you're not subject to them there. So same thing's true here. If you grew up in the United States and the speed limit is 70 miles an hour on whatever highways you travel on, it's a moral failure to violate those laws because you live under them. But if you get on a plane and drive over to Germany and rent a car and get out on the Autobahn, hey, suddenly you can drive as fast as you want to and it won't be a moral failure for you to function outside of the boundaries of the issues of the laws that have never been set over the Germans. I mean, they don't have to pay attention to American law. And when you're over there, you don't either. But when they come over here, they do, because there's an issue of jurisdiction for laws. So on the one hand, it's not a moral failure to operate within the boundaries of the laws that are set over you, but it's also not a moral failure to act outside of the boundaries of laws which have never been set over you. You can't be held accountable for laws that have never been imposed on you. Paul actually said in Romans 5, where there is no law, there's no sin. So, if the law hasn't been imposed on you, you're not sinning by not doing it. The only actions that are moral failures are those which violate those laws which have been set over us. We are not under any kind of moral failure accusation until we are in violation of the principles of law that we're living under. Now, let's examine that in light of the kinds of laws that have been set over us, and then let's apply it to Peter and his situation there in Antioch. There are two kinds of laws which have been set over us as Christians. There are those laws which have their origin in the character of God, in the character of God Himself. And any violation of the character of God is called ungodliness. It is a moral failure for a person to violate the character of God. we are supposed as Christians to be the children of God, and we're supposed to live under the constraints of His character, so that whatever He's like, we're supposed to be like. And whatever He's not like, we're supposed to be not like. Because those are the boundaries that we're under. We're constrained by His character to define what is right and wrong by His character. So it would be a moral failure for me to do anything that God wouldn't do. If His character drives what He will and won't do, it would be a moral failure for me to violate His character by doing something that He wouldn't do. Those kind of laws have their origin in the character of God Himself, and nothing will change that because God's immutable. He doesn't change. So anything that's rooted in His character is set. You've got to do it if you're going to call yourself godly. If you're going to live with a clear conscience before Him, you've got to align yourself with His character. So that's one kind of law that we have imposed upon us. And then there is a second kind of law that has its origin in the application of the character of God to temporary situations in respect to both means and ends. In other words, God's character would face this temporary situation in view of two things. What is the objective? That's the end. And how do we achieve it? That's the means. And in the character of God's reality, in a temporary situation, there's always an objective and there are always means to it. And therefore, there is an established set of necessities that are tied to that application of the character of God in a temporary situation. I'll give you an example in a little bit. But the fact is, any violation of God's character in application to a temporary situation is also ungodly. If God has a particular objective He wants to achieve in a temporary situation, and He has a particular means to achieve it, then it would be ungodly for me not to follow His example in that, pursuing the same goal by the same means. So we have two kinds of laws that we're subject to. One of them is the character of God issue, where you can't do what God wouldn't do and still call yourself godly. It's ungodliness to violate His character. By the same token, there are some things that God wouldn't do under certain circumstances, and in other circumstances He would. So there's the application of His character to the temporary setting. Now let me give you the illustration. In the Ten Commandments, 9 of the 10 are rooted in the character of God. It'll never be okay to have any other God besides God, because He's the only one there is. So that's one of the requirements. There is a legitimate reason for not making graven images or even attempting to make an image of God and then worshiping it. So it would be idolatrous in that regard. It'll never be okay to commit adultery. It'll never be okay to commit murder. It'll never be okay to steal and to lie and all those kind of things. Those are character of God things. But there is nothing inherent in the character of God that says you got to observe the seventh day. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. God's character doesn't insist on a seventh day observance. Why does He put that in there? Well, the Sabbath commandment, remembering the Sabbath day to keep it holy, was bigger than just the seventh day of the week thing. The Sabbath issue was an issue of resting a certain amount of time within the flow of time. For example, there were weekly Sabbaths where you were supposed to rest on the seventh day after working 6 days. But there were also Sabbath rests that, well, like the land, where you work the land for 6 years, and then the seventh year you don't work at all. I mean, you have a year-long vacation on the seventh year. You can't plant. You can't work the ground for that period. So that's a sabbatical thing. Happened every 7 years. And then they had the year Jubilee thing that every 7 times 7 years. You were not only supposed to not work on the seventh year of the seventh set, but the following year was your jubilee, and you weren't supposed to work on it either. So you actually, in your lifetime, if you lived more than 50 years, at some point you would get a two-year vacation from having to work as a farmer, because you were forbidden to. But why did God require that? I mean, what was the big deal? Well, if we look back in the text, the big deal was that observing the Sabbath was the covenant symbol. And if you refused to observe the covenant symbol, you were in effect saying, I have no use for this covenant. Therefore, I'm not going to observe the covenant symbol because I don't want to be under this covenant. Well, in that case, you're just basically rejecting the whole issue of God's covenant with his people. And that rejection was rooted in your refusal to observe the Sabbath. So, in effect, the Sabbath was given as a temporary thing as long as God was in that covenant setting with those people, and he required their remembering the Sabbath day because that was the symbol of the covenant as he established it. As soon as that covenant was off the scene historically, observing the seventh day was off the scene historically. People don't really realize it, but when you observe the Sabbath as a seventh-day rest thing under divine commandment, you're actually saying, I'm under the Jewish commandment, the Jewish theocracy. I'm under that covenant with God. And the fact is, for the Gentiles, they had never been put under the theocratic. They were never included in that theocratic covenant. That was for a people with a particular land, particular people, and they're the only ones in the whole world that had to observe the Sabbath day because it was a symbol of the covenant that God established with them. And he didn't establish this covenant with anybody else. So nobody else needed to worry about keeping the Sabbath day. It wasn't a moral thing built off the character of God. It was an application of God's character to the setting, but it was a temporary setting. So, in relation to the kinds of laws that are set over us, a person can never violate a fundamental characteristic of God and still call himself godly. He's ungodly at the point of the violation. That's why fornication and covetousness and swindling and reviling, those are things you're supposed to put people out of your fellowship with because they violate the character of God. But in addition to that, there are certain things that he requires that are temporary conditional things based on application of his character to a temporary setting. What's the mark of the new covenant? The Sabbath was the mark of the old covenant. What's the mark of the new covenant? What did Jesus say? This is the blood of the new covenant. What? The communion. That was the sign of the new covenant. This is the new covenant in my blood. Drink it in remembrance of me. So, what is the penalty for abusing the Lord's table in the New Testament? Sick, weakness, and dead. 1 Corinthians 11. Some of you are violating the observance of the Lord's table, and for that reason, some of you are sick, some of you are weak, and some of you are asleep. That means dead. So it's a very significant disciplinary process that God would engage in for people who violated the sign of the covenant that the church came under. Does God discipline with sickness, weakness, and death unbelievers who come into church when the church is giving communion and they take part in the communion service? Does God judge them for that? No, because we're not in the family. They're not under that covenant. There's nothing in the character of God that says you got to eat this and drink this way. There's nothing in the character of God that says that. It's the application of the character of God to the setting. So those are the two kinds of things that you run into in terms of identifying a moral failure. Well, that means then that the issue of moral failure has two sides to it. One's objective and one's subjective. It's a moral failure to violate the character of God in any way at any time. It's transdispensational. All of time is under God's character. So it'll always be wrong to violate his character through time. But it's a higher level of moral failure to deliberately violate the character of God at any time. Now, there's a difference between those two things. A violation of the character of God is a violation of the character of God, whether you know it or not. And it's a moral failure to violate His character, whether you know you've failed or not. It's making a difference whether you know. But if you do know and you choose to do it anyway, that's a higher level of moral failure. That's a deliberate violation of the character, because the failure assumes knowledge of what God's character does require. And not everybody has the knowledge of God. So lots of people will do lots of things that are violations of God's moral character, but they don't know it. It's a moral failure, but it's not at the level of the moral failure of the person who knows what God's like and chooses to violate His character anyway. So, the greater problem with the greater moral failure is that it kills the ability of the person who's involved in it to trust God. Paul says to Timothy in 1 Timothy 1:19 that people cause shipwreck of their faith by violating their conscience. You abandon conscience and you just make a disaster for yourself. Why? Because when you know you're in rebellion against God, you cannot trust Him. You're not in the right frame of mind to be able to relax in confidence. So, the issues here are the question of the moral failure that Peter was acting like the Gentiles were guilty of after the moral police showed up. The problem is that the moral failure in this case was entirely Cephas's, not the Gentiles. Before the people from James came, Cephas was operating perfectly in harmony with God's character and what he knew of the application of God's character to his setting. He had been to Cornelius' house. He had been told by God, according to his own words in Acts 15, not to call anybody unclean that God had said was clean. That's not Acts 15, that's Acts 10. I want you to look at that. Look at Acts 10 in Peter's defense of himself before the moral police in Jerusalem because he had gone to Cornelius' house. He says in Acts 10, verse 28, these very pertinent words. It says that he said, when he went into Cornelius' house, it says in verse 25, Cornelius met him and fell at his feet and worshipped him. Peter raised him up and said, stand up, I'm just a man. And he talked with him, and he entered, and he found many people assembled. And he said to them, you yourselves know how unlawful it is for a man who is a Jew to associate with a foreigner or to visit him. And yet, God has shown me that I should not call any man unholy or unclean. Now, that's his understanding of the vision of the sheet let down from heaven. That's his understanding. That's what he says God was telling him. It's not my job to call people unholy or unclean. So, even though we do, as Jews, have this traditional understanding that it's unlawful for us to come and associate with a foreigner or visit him, God's not in harmony with that attitude. And He has told me that He's not going to accept that from me. He wants me to accept His statement that I'm not supposed to call anything unclean that God has cleansed. So, that's His interpretation. Now, Cephas had that experience before he went to Antioch in this setting. So we know that he knew that the Gentiles were not involved in anything wrong just because they were Gentiles. Before the people from James came, he ate with them and fellowshiped with them and prayed with them and probably preached to them and you know, everything was peachy until these guys from James showed up. Now, we know that at that point, Cephas went into what we'll just call moral failure. He knew, for one thing, that the Gentiles had never been placed under God's commands for circumcision in the Jewish theocracy. He knew that. He knew that the Gentiles had never been commanded by God to be circumcised, and they had never been placed under the theocratic law They were not part of Israel. He knew that. He also knew that God had given him a divine imperative to stop treating Gentiles as unclean just because they'd never been included in the theocracy. That's the point of Acts 10. He knew that as Jews, they had always treated Gentiles as unclean because they weren't part of the theocracy, but he had been told by God to stop doing that, and he knew that. So not only did he know that the Gentiles had themselves never been placed under laws that they were then required to keep, circumcision, theocratic law, so he couldn't accuse them of moral failure along that line, but he was accusing them of it by withdrawing and holding himself aloof. He didn't say the words, but his actions were holding them accountable for something that he knew they weren't accountable for. And because God had told him to stop doing it, he was doubly responsible. Also, according to Mark chapter 7, verse 19, in the American Standard, not the King James, but in Mark 7, 19, he also knew, because Mark was his understudy and wrote the gospel under Peter's oversight. According to Mark 7:19, he knew that Jesus had said on the occasion that he was being accused of some wrongdoing and eating and stuff, he said, "Don't you understand that it's not what goes into a man that makes him unclean, but what comes out of him? It's not what you eat that makes you unclean, it's what you say with your mouth and the attitudes that you express that come out from your heart. Those are the things that make you unclean." And Mark makes this little parenthetical statement in Mark 7:19 that when Jesus said that, he made all meat clean. All of a sudden you could eat ham and shrimp and catfish, because what you put in your mouth couldn't make you unclean before God. Peter knew that. He had heard Jesus say that. And in conjunction with those realities, we know that Paul already said in chapter 2 of Galatians, verse 11, that Peter knew better, and in verse 12, that his real motivation was afraid of the party of the circumcision. So the real issue in Paul's offense with Cephas was that Cephas was acting like the others were morally failing, when he himself was the moral failure. And that's why Paul called it hypocrisy. He accused Cephas. He says in verse 12, or verse 13, the rest of the Jews joined him in hypocrisy. Well, what is hypocrisy? Well, the word is used in the New Testament. It's variations, the verb and the noun and so. It's used several times. And invariably what it means is that you're putting on a false front. You're trying to get people to believe something about you that's simply not true. When Peter or Cephas withdrew and held himself aloof, he was presenting himself to be a law-abiding Jew, a man of God who was conforming to the laws of God. That was the reason he did it. So he could keep his reputation in front of the circumcision as a man of God. Was he a man of God? No. He was a man of fear, who was afraid of their opinion of him. And he was, in a very real sense, presenting himself in a false way. He wasn't fearing God. He was fearing them. He was saying, in effect, by his behavior, "I fear God and I'm keeping his law." But what he was really doing was fearing them and violating what God had told him to do. So it's a hypocrite. So when we look at verse 13 and see that the rest of the Jews join him in this, basically what we see is Paul saying, and all of the Jews in Antioch watched Peter pull this stunt and they joined him, because it was just as natural for Jews to revert back to their supercilious approach to Gentiles and treat them as second-class human beings. It was natural for them to do that. That's what they'd been doing until they were converted and taught better. So they lapsed back into an attitude of pride and hypocrisy. And the major hypocrisy, Peter identifies in Acts 15 himself. He says, "You are putting on them something that we couldn't ever do ourselves." Now, you can't accuse a guy of being a hypocrite for insisting that you be circumcised if he's been circumcised. He may be a hypocrite because he tells you that circumcision is the only way you can be right with God. That's a lie. So it's a presentation of a false image. But you cannot ever tell anybody that their behavior is the condition for their acceptance before God in terms of rule keeping without condemning yourself as a hypocrite, because Peter says we couldn't do it. As Jews, we couldn't do it. Paul even says in Galatians 2, he says, verse 16, we Jews know that a man's not justified by the works of law, but through faith. Even we, Jews, have believed in Jesus Christ so that we might be justified by faith in Christ, not by works of the law, since by the works of the law shall no flesh be justified. So to hold himself aloof because people were not operating by the theocratic conditions of the covenant was a huge hypocrisy, because they've never done it themselves. I'm not going to have anything to do with you because you're not living according to the law of God. Even though I'm not either. See how hypocritical that is? And that's the point. That's the reason why in some letters Paul will actually insist that we be moral police, but in our insistence we cannot be hypocritical. I cannot refuse to fellowship with another believer because he's an idolatrous person if I'm an idolatrous person. That would be hypocrisy. Now, neither one of us is supposed to be doing that. The rest of the church ought to shun both of us for being idolaters. But the fact is, hypocrisy is presenting an image that's just not true. I'm walking with God and you're not. Well, that's okay if you're walking with God. But if you're not, it's hypocritical. That's why Paul confronted Cephas here. Cephas thought he had some way to explain why he was acting like this, but he really didn't. Because it was hypocrisy. So my point this evening is we have to make a distinction in our thinking about why Paul would counsel us to be moral police on some occasions, but then he would really come down on Peter for being a party of the moral police in that setting. And the reason is that it was gross hypocrisy. The Gentiles really hadn't done anything wrong, because they weren't under those laws. And for Peter to say, in order for you to have lunch with me, you've got to start conforming to this law, that was just sheer hypocrisy. He wasn't walking with God anymore either. He was fearing the circumcision.